Welcome to Finding Meaning in the Mysterious. I'm your host, Marcy Wise, and I've spent the majority of my life examining our journey with an analytical eye and an open heart. Even as a child, I was in awe of the amazing wonders of the unexplained. I desired to know the truth, not someone else's truth, but the truth I would recognize by my own inner knowing. I entered the world of mass communications in order to bring people understanding and valuable information to help them in their daily lives. My efforts have brought me here, to you, and together we will explore the greatest mysteries of life and attempt to perceive their truths through our own investigation. However, in this forum, we will not only judge using our minds, but by using our hearts as well. Because true knowing always comes from within the heart of each individual, and my goal is to put you in touch with your own inner knowing. Let us begin.
Welcome to the show. Have you ever wondered what happens to us when we die? Saying goodbye to a loved one is one of the hardest things we ever do. And I think part of what makes it so hard is that we don't really know what's on the other side of that door. I mean, we may have a notion in our heads of heaven or an afterlife, but a big part of the pain of losing someone is the vagueness of that vision. Well, today we're going to try to gain a little more information about what actually happens to the soul after we die. We've all heard about cases where someone was pronounced legally dead and then later brought back to life, and the amazing stories they tell about their experiences during that time. They're called near-death experiences, or NDEs, and although no two are the same, studies show that there are certain patterns that are remarkably experienced again and again. We'll take you through that journey and share the most common events that have been reported by those who died and returned to tell about it. We'll also speak with an expert on the topic to see how science explains this phenomenon. But first, we'll talk with a man who actually experienced a near-death experience over 40 years ago. Jeff Searcy was only 13 years old at the time, but he says the things he experienced have had a profound effect on his life. Yet he's kept it a secret all these years and has only recently begun to tell his story. Jeff, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Well, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
So tell us a little bit about what happened to you in 1961.
Well, we were playing a street life baseball game in the mills, the warehouse area, and I was on third base, the telephone pole. The batter swung at the ball, and because we played out on the street, the knob at the end had been broken off, and the baseball bat slipped out of his hand and hit me in the forehead like a torpedo. Well, I never saw it coming. So I could hear the kids around me saying, oh, it doesn't look good. Somebody better go and get his parents. And it was about that time that I realized that I was, like, sitting on top of the telephone pole, looking down, watching my friends and me laying in the street.
So you actually felt separate from your body at that point?
Yes, I did. But, you know, I was only 13. I didn't realize what was going on. And when they said Johnny was going to run to get my parents, I watched him run around the corner of the mill, and the next thing I knew, I had been elevated. And I was now looking over the top of the building at him running down the next street. And my body and my friends were smaller in the foreground. Finally, I was up high enough that I could see two blocks away and watch him run up the front porch stairs into my house. A minute or so later, I saw my father leading the charge down the stairs and my mother behind him and then Johnny. And this time I was up so high that all I could see was like a circle of people on the street with my legs sticking out, and it was like a football huddle.
So did you actually see the ambulance come for you?
Yes. At that time, to my right, I heard the siren, and I was looking across half of the city, watching the ambulance come with the light blinking and the siren blaring. And the kids were saying, hey, look at him. His nose looks like a pig's nose. I guess when the bat hit me in the forehead, it depressed my forehead enough that picked my nose up and knocked one of my eyes out. It was partially hanging on my cheek. But my mother, I could hear my mother's voice saying, Jeffrey, don't die. Jeffrey, don't die. And it was about that time I saw what I said was an angel just hovering in the air, making a right-hand gesture down towards the street. And I would look at her do that and say, what are you telling me? And she would gesture again, and I was getting higher up into the plants, I guess, and my body and the people were smaller, but I could still hear my mother saying, you know, Jeffrey, don't die, don't die. And then when I looked at the angel and I saw her arm swing down again, I thought to myself, are you telling me to go back to the body? And in that instant, I was laying on my back looking up at my mother and father and my friends. And I just told her, don't worry, I'm here, I'm not going to die. And that's when they put me in the ambulance and took me away.
Oh, what did the angel look like?
I guess for me at the time at 13, you know, it just looked like an angel you see a picture of maybe on a holiday card. Long blonde hair, white outfit, blue background. Not really smiling, not really doing anything, just a regular straight face with a kind of just a motion gesture with her hand.
Did she have wings?
I say she did, yes. I then went into a coma for 31 days or 32 days. And when I came out of it and I was talking to my parents and I told them the story, they both encouraged me not to spread the word around because people would think I might be crazy.
And that was something I think people did a lot in the past, is they would kind of keep those sort of spiritual experiences to themselves for fear of judgment from others.
Yes, yes, ma'am.
Were your parents surprised when you finally regained consciousness and was able to repeat some of the things you'd heard while you were laying on the ground?
Yes, they were very surprised with that. Also, the first hospital they took me to, our family physician came out and looked at me and said, you know, Bernice and Larry, I need to speak with you. Come to my office. And I heard him walking down the hallway and the door closed. And it was as if I was, my ears were in the room with them. I heard him say, you know, this is a small hospital, and, you know, if he stays here, he's going to die. You need to take him to a big city like Albany or Schenectady in New York. And when they came out and said, we have to go for a ride, I said, I know, I heard you. Let's go do it. And they were kind of, like, surprised with that. And we got into the ambulance, and then they took me to the St. Clair's Hospital in Schenectady, New York.
What's changed that makes you want to reveal your story today?
Well, my mother passed away 15 years ago and my father only 2 years ago, so I thought it was time to get it off my chest. And I've been seeing more and more of it in advertisements, movies about it, magazine articles about it, live TV people interviewing, talking about it. And, you know, I'm saying to myself, you know, that happened to me over 40 years ago. I want to say what happened to me too, so I can at least get it off of my chest, maybe be a contributing member. I know there are some professors at certain colleges and universities doing research about it, and they've contacted me when they heard about me also, so I participated with them.
Now, I know that Dr. Jeffrey Long had done some extensive research on near-death experiences, and you took part in one of his research projects, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
And what sort of things did they ask you or have you do?
Well, they asked just certain questions similar to the ones you are asking now. And then they tried to categorize them to see if there was a commonality between different types of injuries, different types of near-death experiences or out-of-body experiences. And he said that one of the things they've come up with the university where he is an instructor and around that part of the country, that they put placed objects in the emergency room up on top of like cabinets that can't be seen from eye level or the ground. And when people say they were out of their body in an operating room, they say, well, you know, can you describe anything you may have noticed on top of any of the cabinets or any numbers on top of them? So I think that's kind of a follow-up way. I know I was looking down, seeing my body laying in the road and my friends. So I thought that was an interesting concept to kind of add some validity to someone saying they were out of their body.
Oh, that is interesting. Since you've experienced that, how do you feel about the prospect of dying now?
Right now and for the past 25 years or so, I am not apprehensive at all about it. I'm sure it will be fine. I'm not afraid of it. I'm not worried about it. I don't even really think about it. If it's going to happen, it will, and I'm okay with it. I think I've already done that once, and I was denied entry. It was like, go back and do what you're supposed to do down there. And since then, my son has been born. His children, my grandchildren have been born. I'm still in public education. I've been a teacher for 38 years in the public schools. I've taught thousands of kids. I hope influence some of them positively. And even adult interactions. So I'm here for a reason. I just don't know what it is. So I'm just living my life and hoping I'm doing the right thing.
Being someone who has experienced this, what would you say to people who haven't? What sort of information do you think this gave you or insight that maybe someone else wouldn't have?
Well, I think ultimately it's the idea of passing from this life to another life, leaving the physical body. And that's the way it will be for me in the future, then, you know, I have no fear of it. Obviously, my body was damaged, and I was supposed to be in a lot of pain, but yet I was not. And I also think that it's probably possible, if you're with a loved one and they're passing from one side to the other, that even after maybe the doctor has said that they have passed and they are deceased, that they could still hear you and still see you. Because I know I could still see and I could still hear. So that's been an interesting thought for me.
And you say your parents have passed. Did you feel like you have a better understanding of death? Maybe you're a little more soothed than the average person would be because of what you've gone through?
I would agree with that statement, yes. I really do feel that way. It's kind of hard to explain, having kept these thoughts inside for so many years. And even my relatives, when I started to tell them about it last year or 2 years ago, they were shocked that I kept that secret for so long. Mm. But it's all good.
Yeah, well, that's the one common experience that we all share, no matter who we are or where we are.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, thanks for joining us, Jeff. We appreciate it.
Okay, it's been my pleasure.
Well, descriptions of near-death experiences are nothing new. They've been reported since the time of Plato and in a variety of different cultures around the world. The Near-Death Experience Research Foundation is devoted to the study of near-death experiences, and although no two are identical, certain patterns have become evident. So let's take a look at some of the most common experiences of those who have died and come back. Well, as Jeff said, the first thing is they feel themselves rising outside the body to view the scene from a distant place in the room. Or in his case, you know, he was up, he sat near the telephone wires looking down at his body in the street. They say that they are not able to interact physically with anyone or anything, but they're watching it from a distance perspective. They can also hear and see the details of what's going on in the room. Many of them have reported even hearing their own pronouncements of death. They also say that they feel this strong feeling of peace and calm within them, emotions that are more powerful than you might ordinarily experience. Many report hearing distinctive sounds. They report hearing unusual noises. Some have described them as hearing a buzzing or a ringing. Others have said that they hear pleasant musical sounds. The ones who've heard music often describe it as beautiful beyond what is worldly possible. It's just the most soothing, beautiful music. Another common trait is once they have watched their bodies being resuscitated and worked on from above, they feel themselves passing through a dark tunnel. That's quite common. The movement through the tunnel can be slow or fast, and occasionally another being accompanies them through this tunnel, but usually they say that it's traveled alone. At the end of the tunnel, they report seeing a bright light, and this light is perceived as a being and accompanied by an intense feeling of love and joy and peace. This is where people say that they're thinking they don't want to come back, that they feel so complete and so loved in this space with this being. Many times they report meeting others on the other side. Many encounter other spiritual beings or departed loved ones. Some have said that they've seen deceased pets or have encountered other animals as well. It's common for people to say that they have a knowledge of the life that they've lived. It's like a life review. Some of them report seeing moments of their past life in extreme detail. But this time, they feel how their actions affected the others around them. You know, it's sort of a, you know, walk a mile in another man's shoes. Not only are you seeing what you did in your life, but you're feeling how you affected others. Many say that they've visited beautiful locations, traveled to beautiful cities or libraries or gardens. They've seen pastoral scenes or shiny bodies of water. There's also a sense of knowing universal order and purpose many times. They claim that they receive a deep sense or understanding of the universe and the meaning of life and purpose. Many state that they were shown enormous knowledge, but that they couldn't return with it. Others felt that they did return with their understandings. When asked to describe what our purpose is here on Earth, by far the most common concept discussed is love. Love. We're here to love one another. At that point, it's common for people to say that they reach a boundary of some sort. They come to a gate or a cliff, a fence. Perhaps it's water or some other barrier that they believe cannot be crossed if they're to return to their body. Sometimes people say that they have an awareness of future life events. Some visions may involve the experiencer's future life or may be more global. Sometimes you'll hear people say that they have visions of what will happen here on Earth. This sort of prophecy is very controversial and has been the subject of much debate, but later in the show we'll actually talk to a man who says he received such a vision, so be sure to stay tuned for that. Well, the next point that seems to be common in these near-death experiences is that after they've received some idea that they have to come back, they have to consciously make that decision to return. Now, they say that that can be voluntary or involuntary. If voluntary, the decision is often made following a discussion with a spiritual being or often associated with unfinished life lessons or responsibilities that they know that they have to tackle before they can truly move on. But whether voluntary or involuntary, they say that there's a feeling of sadness or loss. They feel depression or anxiety about having to come back, because there was such a feeling of love and completeness on the other side. When they return to their body, they say that they're often aware of the pain immediately. Once they feel themselves back in the body, no longer hovering the scene or separate, the pain of what's happened has come back to them. Another interesting thing, too, that is reported many times is that psychic or paranormal abilities will appear after something like that. The way they explain it is they feel like they have a marked increase in intuitive ability. Or another thing they report is electrical sensitivity, where they discover their watches stop working, or if they pass under a streetlight, the streetlight goes out. There's never been a good large-scale scientific study on the phenomena, but 54% of near-death experiences report this. After having a near-death experience, many, many people, as a matter of fact, it's 91%, studies say, experience a change in their attitudes and beliefs. It's not uncommon for them to have a belief in God, even if they didn't have one prior, loss of the fear of death, and they feel like they are more alive in their current lives. They're more involved in living and excited to experience. So all of this leads to the question, how does science view this phenomenon? John Audette has studied near-death experiences for more than 30 years. He's the original founder of the International Association for Near-Death Studies and the president and CEO of Quantrek Incorporated. John, welcome to the show.
Well, I'm glad to be here with you today.
Oh, great. Well, thank you. Now, we need to make it clear that you're a healthcare administrator by profession, not a medical doctor. But over the last three decades, you've worked with some of the top researchers on the subject, including Dr. Raymond Moody, who wrote the incredibly successful book Life After Life, which sold over 3 million copies worldwide. Tell us a little bit about your work with Dr. Moody.
Dr. Moody and I met in early 1974 when he was still a medical student at the Medical College of Georgia in Augusta, Georgia. We met through a classmate. I was seeking a speaker to come to campus and
she told me all about Dr. Moody's work. So I made it a point to be introduced to him, and we hit it off and became best friends instantly. And it was the first time that I think I've ever experienced the call of destiny. It was sort of a defining moment when we met. And he asked me if I would help him with his research, and I, of course, accepted enthusiastically, and that's how it all began. And from that point forward, we worked together in data collection, and I did library research and some administrative tasks for him, culminating in the writing and publication of Life After Life in 1975.
Now, it's such an interesting topic, but can you explain to us exactly what is considered a near-death experience?
The near-death experience, the NDE as it's called, the acronym, is pretty much confined to people who are near-death for one reason or another, or clinically dead. And it's a transpersonal peak experience that occurs to some of the people who come near-death.
Mm-hmm. How common is NDE?
Well, that's a great question. It's one that people have struggled with for about, 40 years or so, to my knowledge. It's not one we have a really good answer to. I can give you a rough idea based on all the various opinions that have been offered, but it's clearly not the majority. So we have to say that for those who meet the physiologic or biologic criteria for being near death, that would be no heartbeat, no breathing, unconscious, no blood pressure. For people in a state of clinical death or being resuscitated, only about somewhere between 5% and 20% will actually come back to report a near-death experience.
Well, what scientific evidence is there for the cause of near-death experiences?
In spite of all of the books that have been written and all of the very smart scientists who've been studying these phenomena that are associated with being near death, science has not been able to explain why some people have them and others don't, nor have they been able to explain what accounts for the phenomenology associated with the near-death experience. A lot of different theories have been put forward, but none of them really stand up under close scrutiny. So, for my two cents worth, I always say, well, science can't explain it, doesn't have any of the tools really to adequately research it. It's very difficult to apply scientific method to this subject matter in a way that satisfies the rigors of science. I tend to take the people who report these experiences at face value and give them the benefit of the doubt. For them, there's no need for proof or explanation. For them, it was a glimpse of the hereafter, and they're convinced that what they experienced is real, and it has a series of profound transformative effects after the fact, and they come away very changed from their experience. So I tend to say, well, until or unless science can explain it in some form or fashion that withstands scrutiny, we should, at least for the interim, give these experiencers the benefit of the doubt and take what they tell us at face value. So there is no good explanation for it, nor is the near-death experience scientific proof of life after death. Raymond has always been very careful to point out in his talks that while these accounts are compelling and while they need to be taken seriously, they do not meet the criteria of proof or evidence of life after death. Mm-hmm. That is something that each person needs to debate for themselves.
Well, how do they account for the commonality of the reports? Because we just went through it on the show, all the similar things, like rising above the scene, feeling that sense of detachment as you're viewing your body being worked on from above, the feeling of love. I mean, there's some commonalities in their studies. Is that right?
Yes. Well, Moody was the first to point that out. He actually, you might, when you look at the literature, you'll see a frequent reference to the Moody model, that phrase. And the Moody model was put forward in Life After Life in 1975, where he described some 15 or more commonly reported elements in the near-death experience. And yes, these are elements that are commonly shared by people who come near death and report a near-death experience. And what's interesting is that the Moody model has been upheld and validated in all lands and in all times. The near-death experience is not a contemporary phenomenon. I wrote a chapter in a book called A Collection of Near-Death Research Readings, edited by Craig Lundahl, Dr. Lundahl. I think that was published back in 80 or 81. And it's all about the historical perspectives on near-death experiences. And the truth of the matter is, these go back, you know, written accounts of contemporary near-death experiences. They go back as far as the time of Plato. So they're in all cultures, all lands, and in all times. And the commonality, as you say, is upheld throughout human history. And that's what gives it so much credence and makes it so compelling as an area of scientific inquiry. So that's why we take it so seriously, because it is such a powerful area of interest and has profound implications not only for science, but for human civilization and for human nature.
Well, as you were saying, if science hasn't been able to validate near-death experience one way or the other, what are some of the common skeptic arguments on the subject?
Well, I think the top three would be depersonalization phenomena, dissociative states, that when an individual is confronted with extreme trauma, psychological or emotional or physical, the body takes over and, you know, it's just sort of a denial syndrome of sorts, that this is not happening to me, and that, you know, you become a subject, or object rather than subject. It's happening to that body, but not to me. And you actually describe in a depersonalized dissociative state, you might describe seeing your body as being separate and apart from your consciousness. And they say that's a defense mechanism of the psyche, and that it will kick in or be triggered by moments of acute stress, such as coming near death. So that's an often times quoted cause or explanation for the NDE. The other is the cerebral anoxia, the lack of oxygen to the brain, which will trigger the endorphin effect and perhaps produce feelings of ecstasy in individuals. Another is a temporal lobe seizure and some range of phenomena associated with epileptic seizures that will cause people to report different kinds of imagery and even the sensation of leaving the body or being separated from the body. So those are some of the top explanations for within the scientific framework, right, within a physiologic, biochemical framework of for the near-death experience. But, you know, when you look at the full range of these experiences and all of the different elements reported by various individuals, becomes apparent that these types of explanations that are based on the physical material interpretation of reality just do not account for all that these patients or individuals report.
Mm. Being in the medical industry, obviously you and the people that you work with come into contact with death more often than we do. Is there a common consensus as to whether there is something beyond this world and life after death?
Well, I wouldn't say there's consensus. I would say that you have people are varied in their beliefs and their values and in their religious convictions. I will say that I recently had an experience. I've directed two hospice programs, and I've been at the bedside of many dying patients and helping them transition. And I've been there with agnostics, with atheists, with devout Christians and Jews, I will tell you that, in fact, just recently I was at the bedside of a very dear friend, a close friend of mine, Dr. Prensky, who died on September 15th of last year, and he, all his life, has been an avowed agnostic, a wonderful human being, but absolutely no concept of what might happen after death, and completely uncertain about whether God exists. And I was with him in his final days, and he reported seeing his late wife, Bryna, coming to greet him and wanting him to go with her. And he reported seeing some other friends and relatives, loved ones who died before, who were all coming to greet him. And he was sort of getting impatient and angry, and why can't I go with them? They're going up to the ceiling. Why can't I go with them? And so, you know, David, at the end of his life, became a real believer in survival of consciousness after death because of his firsthand experience there on his deathbed. And it happens to quite a few people. And if you talk to people who work in the hospice setting who are at the bedside of the individuals who are dying, they'll tell you that there's a lot of evidence for so-called deathbed conversions to the belief that we survive bodily death based on what patients experience in their final moments, oftentimes. But there is no, you know, I mean, the opinions about life after death are as varied as the trees and plants and birds on planet Earth. We have opinions to run the gamut. But if you talk to the people who've had these experiences, there's no doubt in their mind that human consciousness survives bodily death.
Mm-hmm. I wondered about that. I wondered if people that experience near-death experiences have had a religious notion of an afterlife where others who didn't have it. But you say no.
Yeah, some people who have near-death experiences were religious beforehand and stay true to their religion after and become even more so, and they become even more spiritual in different ways, and their experience has deepened their religious conviction, or it has in some way broadened it, and perhaps given them a new perspective. But it certainly does intensify their love for fellow man and their feeling of meaning a purpose in life and their compulsion to perform good deeds and be conveyors of goodwill and to love one another. They're very, very insistent that that's the reason that we're here, to learn to love one another unconditionally. And so it's true that the very religious have near-death experiences, and they come back from their experience even more inspired. It's true that agnostics and atheists also have a near-death experience, and they come back, like my dear friend David Prensky, feeling a whole new perspective on what death is and what life is.
Right, renewed and exhilarated and ready to actually do something tangible with their lives.
Absolutely. Well, yes. I mean, they come back. My mom was dying in November 2006, and my mom didn't have an opinion about any of this, and I tried to say to her, I said, you know, Mom, you know, I just want you to remember you're not your body. She said to me, well, if it's not my body, then whose body is it? I said, Mom, it is your body, but the body is not all there is to you. The body dies, but you do not die. And I've always talked to physicians who treat the terminally ill about semantics. You know, be careful not to tell someone that you are dying, because all that is dying is the body. The consciousness survives the ordeal of bodily death based on what we know from not just the near-death experience, but from the research that's been done in past life recall, the fine research that's been done into after-death communication by Bill Guggenheim in his book Hello from Heaven. So, you know, all of these different phenomena point to the probable conclusion that we are in a body, but we are not the body.
Mm-hmm.
This is what Kubler-Ross used to say often. She'd say the dying patients would tell her that death is terribly misunderstood, that we have a highly erroneous concept of death and what it means to die. And if we really understood it for what it is, and for, if we really understood who we really are and why we're really here, that it would be a much different state of affairs here on planet Earth. And that's why she did her work, and that's why Raymond has done his work, with the intent of helping people to grow into a higher perspective about who we really are and why we're really here.
Mm-hmm. Well, many of the people that I've spoken to who have had near-death experiences, after it's over, they refer to that really as a gift. What, from all the research that you've done, what sort of information do they usually bring back about the meaning of life here on Earth?
Well, they come back imbued with a new sense of purpose. First of all, they completely lose their fear of death. They're no longer afraid to die. In fact, many of them are not want to go back home. I mean, they're very they have mixed feelings about being back in the body and being back in the physical material realm. They would much prefer to go where they where their experience took them, because that was an was a realm of beauty, love, and perfection that to them is indescribable. So, but they know they had to come back to fulfill some important purpose. And so they do totally lose their fear of death, and they say that when their time comes, they'll be ready to go, and they'll go enthusiastically. Mm-hmm. And they come back saying, you know, there is a God, and there is a purpose to life, and there is survival of consciousness beyond bodily death. They come back with the notion that we are all one, that there is no duality, that throughout the entire universe, we are all joined as one. And they believe, they come back with a belief in God. If they didn't have one before, well, they certainly have one after their near-death experience. You know, God who is all-knowing and non-judgmental, and who is the manifestation of pure pure love, unconditional love. And they say that we are responsible for what we say, what we think, what we do, and that we have a life review during the near-death experience, or during the transition from this realm to the next, where we are not being judged by a God or by anybody outside of ourselves. We judge ourselves in the presence of absolute love and knowledge. And we have to account for what we do that is not loving and not kind. So when we're unloving and unkind or uncaring, that apparently is a cosmic no-no. When we are loving, kind, caring, apparently that is behavior that is highly encouraged on the other side. So they say that in the presence of absolute love and knowledge, one day we judge ourselves and we will take inventory of our lifetime and we will see what we did versus what we should have done in full panoramic, three-dimensional manner. And we will actually feel the pain that we caused others in lifetime. So literally what the mystics have said over the centuries, that what we do to others, we do to ourselves, is validated through the near-death experience. What matters most is the love that we've given.
Right. Well, it makes you think that if more of us experience near-death experiences, the world might be a better place.
Certainly it would be an antidote for greed. And I think it would be an antidote for separatism. And I think it would be a catalyst to unify religions around a very simple belief system, which is we're eternal beings, and the purpose of physical existence is to overcome the illusion of the physical material world and learn to be more loving and kind and caring to one another, and to come to the realization that what we do to others, we do to ourselves. So I'd love to live in a world like that, because I think it would be a big improvement over the world we have.
What would you say to someone who's lost a loved one and is suffering? From what you've learned and what you've seen, what sort of insights would you give to that person?
Well, the same I give myself. It is very, very difficult. It's heart-wrenching to lose someone you love. I'm very close to my mother. She died 2 years ago. It stings, and it cuts deep. You don't do grief. Grief does you. And actually, Dr. Moody was there when my mom transitioned, and I, as many times as I've been at the bedside of dying patients, I couldn't even go in. He had to basically drag me in there with a hospice nurse so that I could be with my mom as she transitioned. That's how much it hurt, even knowing what was in store for her. So what I would say to people who are going through and suffering with grief is that I fully understand, and there's a hole in the heart that will always be there, and you always will miss the form. But as Ram Dass has often said, you know, there really is no death in a real sense, or it really is no separation in a real sense. We're connected to our loved ones eternally, and we will see them again when we transition. And if you look at the work of Bill Guggenheim in his book, Hello from Heaven, his phenomenal study of after-death communication, you will see that even while we're living, we can have ongoing communication with those who've died, our loved ones who've passed on. So if we're open to it, and if we can be receptive to these phenomena, it's true that the dying can come back and touch us on the shoulder and communicate with us one way or another. I know my mom came back to communicate with me 3 times after she left. So it's just a reminder, sort of a validation that, you know, I'm not so far away.
Mm-hmm.
And I've taken a lot of solace from those communications. And I speak to her every day as though she were here. And, it's all part of the magic and wonder and mystery of existence. And I've come to the realization that we are eternal beings, and there is no such thing as death. The body is the illusion. And that orientation helps me to be receptive to having communication, which is, I think, why I was able to have that special encounter with my mom.
May I ask in what ways she was able to communicate with you?
It really was psychokinetic. There was a photograph on the hutch of my study of my mother in a frame, and for some reason, this was about 24 hours after she died, and I was at a moment of profound grief, just for missing her, knowing that I was going to get through the rest of my life without seeing her mom. And this photograph fell down on its own, and in such a way that the back, I don't know how it fell. There was no wind, the windows were closed, no air conditioning was on at the time. It wasn't off balance or anything. It just fell. It had been up there for, I don't know, 10 years or so, and in the same place. But this time it fell right in front of me, and in such a way that the backing came off, just enough for me to see that on the back of the photograph was writing. I don't remember writing being on the back of the photograph, but it could have been. But the writing was, to my dear son John, hugs and kisses, love you forever, mother.
Aww.
Now, I don't know if the writing was there before she, I don't remember, honestly. But I don't recall ever seeing it there. I can't say that the writing appeared after she died. I don't know. But certainly the fact that the photograph fell down from the hutch and landed on my desk right in front of me at a moment of tremendous sorrow.
Mm. But either way, that was what you needed to hear, and she got her message there, so that's a blessing.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's called an after-death communication. And Bill Guggenheim, in his book, Hello from Heaven, he wrote about all kinds of different methods that people use who are on the other side to communicate with those of us who are here on Earth grieving their loss.
Well, it certainly is a fascinating topic, and we thank you for helping to enlighten us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
As we said earlier, sometimes those who've had near-death experiences are able to return to their bodies with the knowledge of a specific purpose or mission that they're supposed to accomplish while here on Earth. Eric Haas, who now goes by the name of E, is one of those people. E, are you on the line?
I'm here.
Oh, great. Good to have you.
Thank you.
So now, as I understand it, it was just an ordinary day. You were going to pick up your girlfriend, and you developed a terrible, terrible headache. Is that right?
That's right.
So tell me what happened.
Yeah, that headache. Well, my background is I have a psychiatry training, undergraduate training, and I knew that this headache went on. It was like an ice cream headache that wasn't stopping, and my body was starting to shut down around me. I knew I was having a brain hemorrhage. So I went and lied down in her front lawn because I was at peace and ready to go. I was already starting to bounce out of my body, so to speak, from the pain. And I told her quite clearly twice, do not take me to a hospital. I'm ready to go. I'm just going to go right into that star. I was looking up at the stars, and I felt like I was going up into one in particular.
Okay, so you felt like you were dying at this point.
I knew I was. That's the thing. I knew I was dying. I just felt myself going out of my body, and I was very much at peace with that as I continued to feel like I was going up into this star, which just became this expanding light that I felt was like either sucking me in or was coming towards me, and I was just completely at peace. That's why I told her, don't take me to the hospital. I know this is good. I'm ready to go.
Right, yeah, we hear a lot about that feeling of contentment and people not really wanting to come back.
Oh, absolute love and peace. And the panic that started to set in was her panic and her getting her friend and then dragging me to her car and driving me to a hospital. They got me to an emergency surgery room, peeled back my scalp, took a big chunk out of the side of my head, and they were working inside my brain for about 7.5 hours. And I was watching all this from outside my body.
Did you feel like you had a choice of whether to live or die at that point?
No, that's when I kind of discovered we don't, as human beings, have a choice over. Like, when we leave here, when we come, is kind of in another power's hands. And what I was sure while I was bounced way out of my body, when I was furthest away, like I felt like I was almost like across the universe, across time and space. And I had this vision, like looking back at Earth, from deep space, so I saw the planet I was kind of getting pushed back towards, back into, and I had this vision of that planet completely collapsing and becoming like a dead moon. And then I was kind of turned around, and I saw Earth like more alive than it ever was, and the message I felt I received was, you're going back into your body, and you in your lifetime are going to live to see one of these two things happen. So then, waking up the next day against all odds, I mean, they told my father, they got my cell phone out of my pocket because they had to get permission to operate. And they told him, yeah, he's probably not going to survive. It's less than 2% chance. And it'd be better if he did it because he'll never wake up. There's been so much blood in his brain that, you know, he'll be a vegetable at best. Well, I woke up the next morning after my surgery, asked for my laptop.
So you were ready to get to work right away then.
And I did. I spent the first, like, as soon as I got out of the ICU and got into recovery and got to where, you know, I could use my laptop and get on the internet, I spent the first year after waking up, instead of healing, I was hard at work creating my website, which is consciousconsumers.net, which is all these solutions, all this information I feel like I was uploaded with about how we can get in a biologically symbiotic relationship with the planet, with the life forces. And still felt like I wasn't getting the message out. So then I wrote a book. Because I feel like, you know, humans don't listen to information. Stories, mythology is what gets to them.
Right. So Apocalypse Near, you've turned into a work of fiction just so that it will reach more people?
Yeah, I kind of took the truth of what happened to me and mixed it with this really bizarre fiction. What is that force that has us just biting the hand that feeds, literally destroying our planet? And I kind of encapsulated that voice in this villain against all humanity that's made out of dark matter and dark energy and that's attacking us from within. So it's kind of this neurological, psychological terror story.
You said that you had a vision of two possible scenarios. One was that we are using up our resources and are headed for disaster. And
yes.
The other was, I guess you had the inner knowledge that if we change our ways, we can prevent that?
Yeah, and I think I was given the way to do that, and that's what I put all over my website, like unconsciousconsumers.net. There's all these solutions, all this mathematical data I feel like I was given about how we can do that, and I'm just trying to get that message out. Like the briefest equation that I got, I don't even want to say I came up with, because I feel like this was all put into me, mm-hmm. is E equals C squared. Environmentalism equals conscious consumption, meaning that we're all responsible for this. It's not the government. It's not just corporations. We all consume, and if we were to come conscious about each decision we make in the marketplace and decide we're going to live in environmental symbiosis, that's the healer, and it's an undeniable social calculus, biological calculus equation. It's inarguable that if each one of us kicked our consciousness up that much, we'd live much better, and we would have that better part of the vision where I saw Earth more biologically rich and active and us living better than we ever have, like a new golden age.
Mm. Do you feel that that is your mission and your purpose then for this life?
Absolutely. That's all I've been doing, and from, you know, like this vision that I had and the experience was more real than me talking to you right now, maybe because of its emotional impact, but absolutely real and the driving force of my life. Yeah, it's the only reason I can figure why I was put back here, because I didn't want to come back here. Like I said, I saw my body a mangled wreck on a table, and I was in this light body, completely conscious and still me, but without that biological wreck on the table. I didn't want to get back in there. Yeah, I was like hearing with my mind's eye, my mind's ears, seeing with my mind's eye. Everything was like a direct communication. Not so much in a language, just in direct knowing.
Does that prove to you that there is a greater power at work here?
Yes, like now I don't believe in God. I know there's a God from direct experience. There's a higher power, definitely felt fatherly, in charge of it all. And complete peace and love.
Mm, so in a way, that was a gift for you, wasn't it?
Yes, because it feels like, you know, the modus operandi of this creation of all, of everything, the universe, if you will, is this unity, this peace and love is what is at the center of it all.
Well, what are some of the things that each of us can do to ensure this positive outcome for the planet?
Just look at what you do with your, like, every dollar you spend is a vote either for or against life on Earth. What you consume is, you know, what you're either contributing to or taking away from life on this planet. So just take a look at that. Every time you buy something, is this, you know, do I really need this, and is it helping or hurting life on Earth?
Right. And I guess we can all be an active part of that. All we have to do is just make the right choices.
Yes. It's really as simple as becoming conscious of your affects as a consumer.
Give us your website one more time.
www.consciousconsumers.net.
Okay, thanks so much.
Thank you, Marcy.
Okay. Well, death is something we'll all experience through our loved ones and eventually even for ourselves. We've heard from three different individuals who've had a glimpse of what might be waiting for us on the other side. Although we'll only know for sure when our own time comes, perhaps their examples should make us take today a little more seriously. The message is simple and something we already know. Share the love. Is there something you can do to make the world a better place? Why not make it our mission today to use our lives to create something positive while we're here? If you'd like more information on NDEs, you can visit the International Association of Near-Death Studies website at IANDS.org, or for more on Eric Haas's prophetic vision of planet Earth, you can pick up a copy of Apocalypse Near on Amazon.com.
Thanks for joining us for Finding Meaning in the Mysterious and letting us be a part of your spiritual adventure. To share your own story of transformation or to sign up for our monthly newsletter, send me an email at marcywise@host.theshiftradio.com. Remember, you have the power to discover life's greatest truths, but first you must begin to hear that small, still voice of spirit. And when you do, no one can stand in judgment of that which you feel in your heart. until we meet again, here's wishing you faith, peace, and happiness.